somebody decide, right? This one group decide we need a pump, right?
Right.
Yes, a pump. So there's a pump. And the pump is over here. There. And there. And you had some return flowing in that direction, I guess. You had some return. Through the pump. And there was a replenisher here. Okay? Specification stipulates this must be a closed system, stipulates that the flow to each tank is independent of the flow to the other tanks, and the flow to a given tank increases and decreases as the metabolic needs of the aquatic life in that tank increases or decreases. And so one group, the group that was right up here, said something about they had sensors in the tanks, right? Right? How many people had sensors in their tank?
Right.
And what did they sense?
Oxygen,
nutrient
level. Nobody had pumps.
Variables.
You'll find that people get on bandwagons very quickly. So you're sensing oxygen, is that right? Okay. And then based on the oxygen level, where do you measure the oxygen? You measure the oxygen here, or here, or here?
Here.
You measure here? You measure it at the entrance, you measure it at the exit, or you measure it in the middle? Why do you measure the exit? Because what?
You can see that the oxygen content is leaving. You know, the oxygen content is leaving. You know, it's flowing water from the tank. And it's not much more than the tank.
I followed the beginning of that. I followed the dry sense of oxygen because it tells you something, but somehow water got in there, and I didn't quite understand what that
was. Okay. It's just in the water.
Your oxygen registers, you're getting oxygen, you're getting replenished water.
Okay.
And the water that's exiting is the water that
has already been used up
and has been taken to
water in, pee out.
So that the actual oxygen content of the tank would be more accurate leaving than the exit portal.
Okay, did everybody hear what he said?
No.
You gotta listen instead of talk. You gotta listen.
He's quiet.
Pardon?
She said he's quiet.
So he says that if I measure the oxygen here, then it's always going to be at the highest level because that's the freshest water. But if I measure the oxygen here, then oxygen is lost to the aquatic life in here, and that shows you what's left. So if their metabolic rate increases, I'm going to have less left at the exit. So he wants to measure, he wants to monitor at the exit, which makes really good sense to me. So,
as the rate increases, it would be similar.
So maybe you don't like it to look like that. Okay, so now you got sensors there, okay? Now it says here that, it says here that the flow to each tank is independent of the flow through the other tank. So let's say that tank number three, the level of oxygen leaving drops considerably.
There's no way for me to control it.
So what is your system going to do?
The pumps can only do a certain rate to all the tanks.
You do a certain rate to all the tanks.
On that one, yeah, there's only one pump, so it can only either pump a whole bunch more water into all the tanks at the same time just to compensate for the one tank, but that means that the other tanks are getting too much.
Okay.
There's no way for it.
So there's no way to deal with it.
Right.
Could you set a valve on each one?
Do
it.
There you go.
If you increase the circumference of the pipe going through the tank, then more, it'll decrease the resistance, so you get more flow to that specific tank. So as a response to the low oxygen level, you
could
increase the circumference of that.
Okay.
So a valve.
So what she says is, if in fact there's a lot of oxygen coming out of that, one thing you can do is change the circumference of this pathway, which then will allow more water to come in. One possibility. And the other possibility that somebody over there said is put a valve in. Where would you put the valves?
In the entrance.
In the entrance. You want to put a valve here? What about here? What about the other ones? So Kelly's suggestion is really another way of saying putting a valve in. It's a different kind of valve. But by increasing the circumference, what are you doing? You're decreasing what? Resistance. If you have a valve in here and you open the valve, what's happening to the resistance?
Yeah.
Increasing. Okay, so yeah, you want a valve in there. We'll put a valve in there. We'll say that's an adjustable valve. We still have this issue of one pump. And the one pump can either do so much or whatever. So if you open this valve, so more flow goes through here.
If you have a separate channel to bypass.
Okay, so Megan says, let's make it a variable pump. And if we make it a variable pump, then if this flow increases, then we can increase the rate of pumping of that pump.
And now increase for all the rest of the valves.
How would you make that determination?
From the sensor
from the oxygen sensor? I think she said was, if I see how much resistance there is, then I can determine, I see how much resistance there is. If resistance decreases, then somehow I know I have to turn the pump up. So my question then has to do with flow. What is flow through this whole system dependent? A pressure gradient and resistance. Okay? So is the key to getting constant flow through here when this valve opens resistance or pressure? Could use either one, but it gets a little complicated with that, because then I have to assess in some way what the effect of opening this resistance is on the flows in these various places.
Isn't that just a mathematical equation?
No, not necessarily. Let's think about what happens with pressure. Where would you measure the pressure? If you wanted to measure, if you want to put a pressure sensor in there, where would you measure the pressure? Put it on the right side, okay? On the inflow side?
Yeah.
Okay. And does it make any difference really where you put it? You could put it here, you could put it here anywhere you want. So let's say if we put it up here, we put a pressure sensor. Okay? So now, if I decrease the resistance through here, what's going to happen to the pressure in this tube? It's going to go down, and I can sense that. And then I can feed back and say, okay, we've got to speed the pump up. Okay? Does that make sense? Okay. And what happens if, in fact, these guys are quite dormant? Pressure goes up because she's saying that the resistance here is going to increase. The pressure goes up, then I can have some way of returning that information to the pump and slow the pump down. Okay. So I have some resistance. I have a pressure sensor. The pressure sensor is going to feed back in some way to the pump. And the sensors are going to feed into the resistance. All right. Everybody with us? How many of you had something like that in your model? How many of you had anything like that in any of your models? How many people had six tanks in their models? Okay, we can start there. How many people have sensors in their six tanks? How many people have resistances at the entrance to the six tanks? How many people had a pressure sensor? We have a pressure sensor. Life is difficult. Okay, so what else do we need in here? Is there something that's supposed to measure nutrients? Well, if we're talking about oxygen, we could say I do the same kind of nutrients in the salt. So, in principle, the same thing.
Well,
yeah.
If the water
increases, the question is, might I not have to control oxygen and nutrient levels independently? The answer is yes, probably maybe so, but that's the job of the replenisher, and we're having somebody else design now. Okay? Right. Well, that's interesting. Okay, so now let's see what happens here. Let's say we open this tank up more. And you said the pressure here is going to drop. It's going to cause the pump to increase. What's going to happen to the volume in this tube? Make sure you get it all covered.
I'm sorry, it's so loud.
Well, make sure you get all covered. The interesting thing is, that I find interesting is that actually there are actually people who see my wonderful artwork and think maybe it'd be worth something later, so they have to write down. So what's going to happen to the volume in this side? But we said we're gonna change these resistances. The pressure's going to change and cause the pump to pump more. So let's say we have to, if we open this tank and open that tank and the pressure falls, okay, that means the pump has to pump faster to get this pressure back. Okay? You only have so much water in the system. So where is it going to get that water? From this side? Okay. And if it's going to do that, should we have rigid pipes over here? Or should we have extensible pipes over here? Sorry? Extensible? Why?
This is like the cardiovascular system.
So they can accommodate more or less fluid. That makes sense, because if you have rigid pipes, you have a fixed fluid, and you're going to empty this, you can't really get the flow because you don't have the volume, because the flow is volume time. Or otherwise, or the other thing to say is that you're going to in some way compromise the pressure difference across here that's causing the flow. So you want to have the sensible tubes in there. And what else might you want to do to that compartment? Put valves in it. What for? You think about the heart. But the heart is the pump. Okay. So now we have to ask ourselves, are these tanks on six floors? Or are they in one big building that's at ground level?
12 floors.
What do you think? You're the designer.
I want them on multiple floors.
You have it at ground level. So if you have it at ground level, you think you need valves on the outside.
We're assuming that if it's a ground level preventer valve, they have this.
Whereas if it was at six floors,
and my gardening,
why would you want valves on that side? Gravitational force, I don't know what that means. There's no osmotic pressure in this anywhere. Except maybe these exchanges, but I don't know anything about these exchanges because they're out there. What does osmotic pressure mean?
Water.
What does it relate to?
Water.
Water movement.
Across the membrane.
Where?
Across the semicolumbal membrane.
Across the membrane.
Place
it's across the semicolumbal membrane. You didn't talk anything about semicolumbal. So it's hydrostatic, but why would you want a valve in here somewhere? If in fact that's the sixth floor and that's the fifth floor.
But then that's
the
backflow.
If the flow slows down, you don't want to have backflow, which means that if in fact you had a pump from here to here, from the first floor to the sixth floor, you had to build a lot of pressure up here to push that water all the way up. But if you had valves in here periodically, then the distance that you have to push is from this compartment to that compartment. Because once the water got on there, if you push force down here, that valve is closed. We have to think about how valves work to do that. But if you're having this all on the same level, then you really don't have to worry about valves. All right. Might you have something that's going to adjust, your volume in this apartment.
Of the outflow compartment, the supply compartment. But you want to have some adjustment there of the volume there? There are two possibilities.
Yes.
Why might you want to do that?
Talk about our 6-story.
No, either one. We're talking about, let's talk about on a level in the hangar. So,
has the amount of inflow at the last one. So if you think of each of those tanks as like inlets into a stream, the stream should be bigger on top. There's going to be something adjusting to the backflow.
Okay, that's a possibility. He says if I have flow coming through here, the amount of flow here is less than the amount of flow here, maybe, because now I've got two tributaries. So the river is getting bigger. Mm-hmm. Possibility. He told me these would be distensible tubes. If they're distensible tubes, then there's no adjustment. Of the recoil in the distensible tubes, is there not a danger of when you increase the flow and you get more flow through here, that increased flow is just going to fill this up more, and you're not going to have a whole lot of return back. So I'm going to lose this pressure over here. Is that a possibility? You know what I said? Oh, you didn't know what I said. But you have an imbalance. Which is very interesting because if you see what happens here, if we open a lot of these up, and this pressure drops, and the recoil in here stays the same, what you really need to do to keep this pressure up is you have to get more volume on this side, don't you? Because what is pressure dependent?
Volume
and in this tube, what is pressure dependent on? What'd you say? Pivner's law. So what is that's true. So if the volume changes and the pressure changes, so what we said was if the volume decreases, assuming NRP stays the same, total number of molecules in there stays the same. But that's not really what happens if you need to put more in and less in. So what in a simpler sense, what is the pressure in that container depend on? The volume now I need elasticity because I don't know what that word means.
Recoil.
Okay. So volume depends on the pressure depends on the recoil volume. If I have this side as you didn't say whether that's an extensible or not, but if you have that some degree of recoil there, and I now get rid of volume because I've increased the pump go through this path, then what's happened to the volume here? It's gone down, right? The pressure's gone down. And we said we would speed the pump up to replenish that volume and restore that pressure. Then it had to come from here. So this side really needs to be a volume reservoir of some sort. So in this system, what do we have? If we look at the basic components, what are the basic components that we have? Let's number them. What's the first basic component? The pump. What's the second basic component?
Tubes.
Pressure sensor?
The tubes.
Just in general. The tanks, you said.
The animals.
Okay, so the tanks are actually the exchanger in here. That's one thing in the tanks, okay? Pressure sensor, and what's it? Where is it sensing pressure? In the inflow. And so this compartment right here serves what function?
A reservoir.
Reservoir for? No, for pressure. Because that's why you put the sensor there. Because you want to keep this. So you have a reservoir. You have a reservoir for pressure. And any more components that you want to think about?
Other side.
The replenisher is not in our pump. What about the outflow reservoir? And what was that a reservoir for?
Volume.
A volume reservoir. So we said we have a pump. We have tanks, which includes the exchangers, which we're not designing those, so we'll just say they're there. We have a pressure reservoir. And we have a volume reservoir. So, okay, all of you who are real hot to trot. Wait a minute. The other piece that we had in here was we had some valves over here. We'll call that 3'. And we had inlet valves. Because they are tied to pressure in some way or flow. So those of you who said, I can't think of any of this without thinking about the cardiovascular system, let's think about the cardiovascular system now. Now we've seen some components that we think we want to have in our system, so let's put labels on them, physiological labels, as they relate to the cardiovascular system. What's the pump? How many pumps are there? Is there one pump or two pumps? There's two pumps. Where is it?
Oh, good one. I like it. That was good.
So we said, so why should we think about the heart being two pumps? Well, not completely. First of all, the lungs are not the only replenisher.
Oxygen is the only replenisher.
And they do other things besides replenishing. So what's different in the cardiovascular system than in Seymour Fisher system? No, big difference. Major difference. No, that we are the designers of Seymour's system.
We're not the designers.
Blood versus water.
What's the major difference between what you know about the cardiovascular system and Seymour Fisher's system?
It's more
than
the system, all the tanks are on one circulation.
You don't have fish in your heart here either. I'm sorry, I didn't hear back there. Somebody said.
I was saying on our fish example, all of the areas that water are going to are on the same circulation system, and on our physiologically in our bodies, it's on two different circulations.
Okay. Seymour Fish's system has one circuit. And if we look at the cardiovascular system, we're dealing with two circuits. So everything that we might consider going on in CMOR's one circuit, we may think of having two of if there are two circuits. So we're going to think about a pressure reservoir for both circuits. We're thinking about resistance for both circuits. We're thinking about a volume reservoir for both circuits. We're thinking about a pump for both circuits. So those two pumps, one going to the pulmonary circuit, one going to the systemic circuit, happen to be enclosed in the same box. There are two pumps because there are two circuits. And later on, when we talk about what the replenisher is, we're going to find out that depending on what you're talking about, the replenisher could be the lungs, could be the gut, could be the liver, could be the kidney, could be the spleen, depending on what aspect of the replenisher you're talking about. Okay. That's good. So you have two pumps. And am I going to expect a fundamental difference between the mechanisms involved in the two pumps? And why is that? But they're doing the same thing, they're pumping. No, they're both pumping for the same purpose. They're both pumping to generate pressure to cause a flow. That's certainly true, but the question was, if I look at these two pumps and I think about the principles involved with the actions of the pumps, would I expect them to be different?
No.
No, I wouldn't. Why not? Because they're basically doing the same thing. They basically have the same components. They have some valves in them, and they have ventricles, whatever they do, and they have atria, whatever they do. So there may be quantitative differences between the two pumps. Because the resistance on one side may be greater than the resistance on the other side. But if I think about fundamental concepts, fundamental principles and fundamental features. How do we expect to see the same thing on both sides? Okay. What would you consider the pressure reservoir? If we're now talking, we'll split this up and we'll talk about the systemic circulation. What would you consider to be the pressure reservoir? Artery. Okay. What do you think represents the inlet valve?
The valves themselves are like the muscular parts of the arteries.
Whole artery has muscle all along that can increase or decrease in size. So the valve would be more like the entire length of the artery.
The thought. What she said was there's smooth muscle in the because Rich told me. Rich told me about arteries. Yes, did he tell you about arteries? Yeah. Not yet. How are you supposed to know how you get blood if you don't have any arteries? You don't know about arteries. You know, there's smooth muscle in arteries, arterial wall. But where?
You mean the degree of contraction of the smooth muscle?
Oh, maybe, but that's what we're talking about, the flow. We're not talking about the flow. And so these, you're saying, are the arteries. And we talked about little valves here. So what you're saying is true, Kelly, that the smooth muscle in the arteries can contract and increase their tone. But in the aorta and in the large arteries, they're really not they're not affecting the resistance through the system from here to here as much as these little valves that you put in there.
Right.
Okay? They're affecting the compliance. They're affecting the recoil of these big vessels. But compared to these little resistances here and there through the entrance of the system, they're really not contributing to the overall resistance between here and here. That's a good thought. So what, where would I find, you didn't talk about anything in the cardiovascular system?
Are you thinking about like the capillary beds controlling the rate of flow?
But you haven't looked at capillaries yet, have you? Capillaries don't have these blood vessels.
No, but you do have sphincter control to control like how much blood goes into
okay, so she says we do have some kind of sphincters. What kind of vessels are those sphincters in?
Arterial.
They're arterial. Okay. So this resistance and that resistance and that resistance is in the arteriolar bed. We'll come back to that in a bit. And what do you think this is then? What's the volume resonance? The what? The veins, the venous system, the major veins, the larger veins. And so that's what we're going to do. We're going to start talking about how we start a cardiovascular system. The first thing we're going to look at is the pump. We're going to ask certain questions about the pump. We're going to say, what causes the pump to pump? And what are the characteristics of the pump that allow it to pump? That allow it to speed up its pumping and slow down its pumping, because that's what you said. Megan said it's got to be able to speed up and slow down. Second thing we're going to think about then is what goes on in this arterial compartment? And how, what is it that controls, or what is it that determines arterial pressure? Where do I mention it? Third, then, is going to say, what is it that determines blood flow through these various regions? And you already told me that one way to do that maybe is to measure, get some measure of the activity in that tissue bed. So what you told me really is that control through this bed is local. Right? Let's consider another situation. And let's say that something happens Seymour's system is going to be fan, everything seems to be working really, really well, and all of a sudden Something breaks down. And so this compartment, this aquarium, this tank, senses only what's in his tank. He can't really oversee what's in the whole system. Does Seymour have to hire somebody to monitor the whole system to make sure it's working right? And maybe make adjustments to the various tanks that are going to maintain that whole system, because if the environmental conditions in each tank are not maintained in a reasonable way, the fish are going to die. If the fish die, what happens to Seymour fish? Goes out of business. Right? It goes out of business because nobody will lend them any more money in these days to buy fish or fish food or maybe even water. So you think there has to be some sort of an oversight mechanism here to make sure that the overall well-being of the whole site is maintained.
Yeah.
So now I'm going to have some other sensors other places. Or I'm going to have these sensors not only feeding the local things, but feeding where? To some central monitoring station. So now we have central control, and we have local control. And we're going to think about that, and we're going to think pretty much about local control as controlling blood flow, and central control is doing what you do, controlling what? In this system. The what? The pump. And ultimately, what is it that determines the pump? What is the pump? What's being measured? What's the variable that's regulated?
Pressure.
So we're going to have a central control that's going to deal primarily with pressure. We're going to have a local control that deals primarily with local flow. And that's our overview. Those of you who wanted the big picture, that's the big picture of the cardiovascular system. Are there questions?
Talk about
other types of sensors and whatnot. Are you getting into anything outside of pressure as far as like constant? In the cardiovascular system? I'm not sure I understand what your question is. Your question is, are there other sensors involved in this system? The answer is yes. Are there sensors involved that are, what kind of sensors would you call those that might be involved?
I guess I'm thinking more from the standpoint of like oxygen level or
some blood, okay.
Give some kind, or CO2
right.
level.
And so if you have an oxygen level or a CO2 level, what kind of receptor would you have? A chemical receptor, a chemoreceptor. So yes, we will ultimately look at chemoreceptors in various places, not necessarily in terms of the cardiovascular system, but when we get to the respiratory system, we will. And where do we find these? We find these in the cardiovascular system. Okay. And we will find, as we talk about homeostasis in various places, we'll find that there are all kinds of other sensors, that there are some mechanical receptors, and there are some chemoreceptors, and other kind of receptors that contribute to the overall control system, the overall regulatory systems in the body. But right now, our major concern is from this model, this is pressure. Okay? Alright, so the first thing we're going to do is look at that pump. And we're going to look at it physically to get some idea of what it looks like and how it feels and where the pads are, what the anatomy looks like. And then we'll start looking at the mechanisms involved with that pump and why they do what they do. What happens if anybody in high school or college do a turtle heart preparation or a frog heart preparation? Don't tell me what that was. What did you do? You did lamb hearts.
Really?
Live lamb hearts.
Live.
Fresh from the slaughterhouse.
No, I don't know.
Did they pump? So you just cut up lamb hearts, right?
Inject them with epinephrine,
then.
Yeah. Did you hook them up to hoses and they pumped?
No.
Did you hook up your frog heart to the turtle heart to hose to the pump, the frog heart?
I don't know, but the frog was still alive.
Did you pit the frog?
What?
Did you pit the frog?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, so the frog wasn't alive.
The
frog wasn't alive, the frog was dead. Well, was the heart dead?
No,
it kept going. Okay, it kept going. So when you pit the frog, what that means is that you took a dissecting needle and you destroyed the spinal cord.
By putting the spinal cord into your
eye. So you disconnected the connection between the brain and the rest of the frog.
But it wasn't alive. So it's like alive.
By that time it was dead. Hi!
Hi!
Come on in, Billy. And so what does
back here.
And then bring with us.
So the question that I ask you, I guess, is, does the brain cause the heart to contract?
No.
Does the brain cause the skeletal muscles to contract? So I guess the question you have to ask is, what's going on in the heart that allows it to contract without having any influence from the brain? So that's one of the questions we're going to ask ourselves. Then we're going to ask, how is contraction of cardiac muscle the same or different than contraction of skeletal muscle? And then we'll move on from there to look at the heart as a pump and see what the mechanics of that is in terms of the plumbing. And then we'll look at the arterial system, capillary system, and your knees. Okay, let's take 10 minutes, and when you come back, clean off your tables, take your stuff off the tables,
so
there's the top, or you run away. We have chucks up here, we have
the sectic, it doesn't matter if it has a
pendulum
or not.
There are a number of parts, there's
still
pieces, there's some gloves on the table, there's some scissors on the table.
The other one,
look at your learning guide in the appropriate place, and it'll tell you what to do.
The trachea definitely has interstitial Yeah, but can the other one grow by interstitial growth, or does it grow by apositional growth?
I was hoping it would start that way.
I'm pretty sure the other one has to grow by apositional growth, not interstitial growth. That is the difference. The I mean, cartilage at the end of long bones has to grow by apositional, right?
Yeah.
That's the difference. What's the following?
That's what I thought.
Yeah. And then when we look this one up, one has perichondrium and one doesn't, right? But the similarity is they don't have less than what. Either way. So,
because they either way, even the epithelium on trachea still gets stuck by diffusion, right?
Yeah, but I'm saying for part D,
because
that's what they were doing, D, so it's more C.
And but if they were talking about hyaline cartilage, in, like if there's hyaline cartilage in the wall, like the small intestine or something like that, then you might have blood vessels right there for absorption.
But it's still not hyaline cartilage. Hyaline cartilage, by definition, is avascular.
Right.
Yeah.
I understand that. So I see what you're saying. Whether it's by it or not, it's still diffusion.
It's still diffusion. Yeah.
That's what we thought. We thought C was a brain, but then they were like...
And that's, yeah.
Because that's what I was like, it's like definition straight up.
Yeah,
interstitial growth versus...
And their argument for D was that because it lacked a perichondrium was the reason that it was avascular. Which
no,
is not
they're
the
always,
reason. They're always avascular. So that's the argument for their answer.
The perichondrium is just has to do with the difference.
Yeah.
That's that has the progenitor cells?
I don't remember. Yes.
Right, so it's the actively growing one. I think that's the reason why they can grow differently.
I need a scan.
I have 12.
May I use one and get one back?
Yeah, as long as you get the same one back.
The same one?
Yeah, I want the exact same.
Okay.
Okay.
You can have the
work.
Exact same one.
Okay. I just want to make sure.
I'll make sure you grade it. Yeah. And then any of the other ones that were questionable were answered via email.
This side goes up. And put two or three on your table in front of the table. Get a tray. Grab some gloves. 6 feet point in, and go to it.
Go with it.
How many groups? But you're working threes or fours, and each three or four of your groups are hard.
I think we're gonna work three
tables. Make about three trucks down here.
You need to go out. Why? Because you can feel left.
The learning guy.
You really are. You're gonna have to.
What?
You're gonna Too much time worrying about all the anatomical terms.
Okay.
you don't care about that, you're going to deal with that next quarter.
Perfect.
And then what you want to do is see what it looks like and see how the left side is different than the right side. And see what the valves look like. See where the rest of them go.
Oh, large flat before an area. What we did end up hitting was right here.
Don't be shy with these things. You want to find out what the inside looks like.
Hey, Coach.
You don't have to pump when you're done, you know. You don't have to show them up and put them back in your...
Hey, Coach.
Grab an issue.
too. It's just thin.
It looks like it does.
Yeah,
yeah,
that's it, right? That's this guy.
It looks like what?
Through
Yeah. And then go to his store.
And then
Yeah, I think that's a good part. Like, there's about six screens.
Yeah. That's the dream of it.
Yeah. Like, we're going to get the show off. They probably are not really
oh, totally.
I'm sorry.
New battery.
I have no body.
Put dirty stuff in the red bag and put the hard stuff in the top.
It was not my inside.
We
And we'll start talking at 3:15 if you want to take breaks. Flow go from the atrium. into the ventricle. When the ventricle is relaxed, she said. Okay? How many people agree? How many people think that the blood goes from the atrium to the ventricle when the atrium contracts?
Atrium to the ventricle?
What is it that initiates the flow from the atrium to the ventricle? The contraction of the atrium? No, it's another way of saying that. Does blood flow from the atrium to the ventricle before the atrium contracts? Yes? No? Well, you gotta listen. The question was, does blood flow from the atrium to the ventricle before the atrium contracts? Is it the contraction what makes it go into the ventricle? How many people think it's the contraction that makes it go into the ventricle? The contraction of the atrium. How many people think that? That's not what Kellen said. What she said is whenever the ventricular pressure is less than the atrial pressure, flow occurs from the atrium to the ventricle. Correct. The problem that we're going to get into later when we really examine this carefully, the problem with the route that you learned in high school is that you learn that in some way as if things stopped in time. That, first the atrium fills up. And then the blood goes to the ventricle. And the ventricle fills up. And then the blood goes to the lung. And then it comes back and the atrium fills up. And then it empties into the ventricle and then the ventricle fills up and it goes out. But what you don't recognize is blood is flowing wherever path can take it. And this is a continuous process. And there are some valves that are opening and closing. But if you listen to what she said carefully, she said that the valve is going to be open any time the pressure upstream of the valve is greater than the pressure downstream of the valve. And the valve is going to close any time the pressure downstream of the valve is bigger than the pressure upstream of the valve. And so it's a little flap. And you saw how flimsy that flap was. Let's take a look at flow through those in an isolated situation. Pay attention. So there's a tricuspid valve. How many cusps?
Three.
Do I care?
No.
Not really. What will I find attached to these flaps here?
Chordae
tendinae. Not saying one of the strings of my heart, but chordae tendinae. They're attached down here. Papillary muscle that are going to pull when that's closed to help hold those flaps closed. Let's watch it without the chordae tendinae. Here's the pulmonary valve. That's the semilunar valve. That's two flaps. And do I need to have any, or do I find any attachments up here someplace?
No.
Because the geometry of this valve holds those closed when this pressure exceeds that pressure. Let's look at that one. Okay, let's look at the mitral valve, the AV valve on the left side. Is the valve doing anything by itself to open? There's the aortic valve.
No.
No, it's not. It's just a passive, flimsy piece of tissue. And we're going to see later on how that can cause some problems if it's narrowed or if it leaks or things like that. We're not going to worry about that now. Questions? Let's read it again. Can't do it in slow motion.
Is there a soundtrack?
There's no soundtrack.
I thought it was
a we can make a soundtrack. There's no love dub here.
I'm only putting that in my head every time I close.
Okay, there you go. Pressure up top is greater than pressure below, the valve is closed. If the pressure below is greater than the pressure on top, the valve is closed. Pressure on top of the valve.
On top of the valve.
Not atrium ventricle. So you might want to say when the pressure upstream of the valve is greater than pressure downstream of the valve, valve is closed. When the pressure downstream is greater than pressure upstream, and the valve is open. All right. So the whole idea of that again is to give you some feeling for what it is that you're talking about when we start talking about various parts of the heart. And give you some sort of mental picture that you can kinesthetically feel, things like that. And you should have realized now that, gee, you know, the atria are elastic structures. Oh, you know, the vessels are elastic structures. Oh, the ventricles are elastic structures.
I have a hard time understanding with the chordae tendineae and the papillary muscles. Do they help the AV valves stay open?
Or stay closed.
So how do they do it from being on the other side? It just doesn't seem like they could push them.
They're not pushing.
And how do they
keep it closed? Okay. I'll show anybody else in a minute. If this valve, this pressure is higher than that, this valve opens, right? Mm-hmm. Okay? If this pressure gets bigger than that pressure, that valve closes. And if I pull down here these flaps together, it's going to stop them from blowing back.
So then,
they're holding them together.
Okay?
Okay, let me show you what we did. Here's the picture. Those were valves. Those were Liddy's hands. And I said, when the pressure here is greater than the pressure here, those are going to open up and you're going to have flow. That's what you saw in the picture. When the pressure down here is greater than the pressure here, the valve has been closed. This is real flimsy stuff. And the geometry is such that if there's nothing to hold these closed, then that pressure can push these back and they have backflow. The valve will actually can push back up into the atrium. So if I connect these down here by connections, and I pull on these connections, I pull on here, then I'm going to hold these closed so I can increase pressure down here, and because these cords are pulling on the flap, that won't blow back.
Where are the connections when it's open?
Connections when they're open are the flaps. So what you saw was cord and tendineae that were connected to muscle down below. That muscle's relaxed. There's nothing pulling on it. And so when the flaps go out, they just float in the breeze. They don't float in the breeze, they float in the blood. No, the papillary muscles contract when the ventricular muscle contracts. And if you found a moderator band in your right ventricle of your hearts, there was a piece of tissue that went across. The conduction system that innervates those papillary muscles on the right side actually passes through that moderator band. On the left side, it doesn't. It goes through the wall. Thank you. Okay. So the next thing we want to think about, is ventricular muscles. The ventricular muscle is an excitable cell. So, what does that mean? It's going to have an action potential, okay? And what does that imply in terms of the wall of the muscle? What does that imply in terms of the muscle cell? Why does it have an action potential? Because it has sodium potassium. Is that why it shows an action potential? No. Gee, I thought the sodium potassium pump was there to maintain the concentration gradient between the inside and the outside of the cell. That's not an action potential. What is it that's responsible for generation of action? Why does an action potential in a skeletal muscle or an axon, why do you get an action potential? No, gradients are just such a thing.
That's because of the sodium.
What?
Sodium?
Depolarization, and what does that cause to happen?
Calcium.
Inflow of sodium.
Voltage gated sodium channels open. Oh, that's it. What kind of voltage gated sodium channel?
Time and activation.
Why is that so difficult? Why is it so difficult to recall that axons and sarcolemmas have voltage-gated sodium channels with time and activation gates and voltage-gated potassium channels? You're under the impression that these two systems don't follow a similar pattern.
But you're going to show
and why is that?
Based on my previous understanding of physiology, which you're going to debunk.
Another way of what Fatima is saying is the nerve is the nerve, the skeletal muscle is the skeletal muscle, and cardiac ventricular muscle is cardiac ventricular muscle, and they're not spelled the same, and they don't look the same, so obviously they can't be the same. Now, what I want you to get used to doing, when you come to something that you think is new, whether it's here, or whether it's in anatomy, or whether it's about chemistry, or whether it's your car mechanic, or whether it's your mother-in-law's, or your cousin Betty's, and you ask yourself, what do I already know about this? What is this like that I already know about? We just got on the third floor, we just got the biggest damn copy machine that we've ever had at this institution. I think the next generation we're going to have to build an addition out in the back to fit in the room. How many of you think you can go up to that machine and make a copy? Well, why? Why do you think that?
Because
you did it on your own. That's experience. And when you were faced with this humongous machine, what's the first thing that you did?
I tried to figure out how to put the yellow paper into
code. How'd you put in the code?
It asked for it.
It asked for it. It said, Charles, what's the code?
15176.
Don't write that down. He used previous knowledge. He said, the last machine, which wasn't mine, they gave me a code. And I found a 10 keypad, and I punched in the code, I pressed the button, and then I pushed something that said enter. Or maybe it said ID. Or maybe. And then lights came on. Lights came on, and I had choices. Because life is all about choices. And then I just want to make some copies. So I pressed in some numbers. And see, the numbers came up. And then I pushed the magic green button. And it started going. And he didn't have a whole lot of problems doing this with this machine he'd never seen before, except for finding the right drawer to put the paper in. He didn't say he had problems with the rest of it. Because you looked at it, you said, oh, you know what? This isn't too different than what we did in the principal's office when I was in the fourth grade, when the teacher sent me to make copies. It's a lot bigger. It's got a lot more options, a lot more choices. But I say, okay, what is this like that I already know about? And you use that information, you use that knowledge to solve the problem. And when, gee, you know, if he couldn't figure out which button to press, he went and said to somebody, okay, where is the enter button?
I actually asked where it was.
Well, but yeah, we're assuming you found the room. Which So, should I expect axons and skeletal muscle and cardiac muscle to be fundamentally different? You hope not. And you're going to find out that there are some differences. Somebody told me the other day, they wrote on their card that they were having trouble remembering the difference between the action potential in the axon and the action potential in the skeletal muscle. What's the difference? One of them is in the axon and the other one's in the muscle. But gee, the gates are all the same, the polarization's all the same, the form is the same, the mechanism is the same. So now, if we talk about this ventricular muscle, and it has an action potential, because you told me it did, Adam told me it did, what would I expect to find in it based on my previous experience? Voltage-gated sodium channels with time and activation gates. What else might I expect to find here? Voltage-gated potassium channels. Now, I'm going to tell you something, because you want to know. Because inquiring minds want to know. I'm going to tell you that in addition to those, there are really only about 8,000 different populations of channels in the ventricular muscle. Maybe not quite that many. Maybe only 65. But every day or two, they label some more and find some more. Because these damn molecular biologists are just never satisfied till they find a new protein that does something. But we can now take that and simplify all those down to three populations. Three populations of channels. There are voltage-gated sodium channels and time activation channels. There are voltage-gated potassium channels. And here's the thing that's different. It is a new piece. There are also voltage-gated calcium channels. Okay? So unlike skeletal muscle, unlike axons, now we have some voltage-gated calcium channels. And if I look at the relative permeabilities, this is on page chapter 7, what I see in those populations are some characteristics. one, which is the top one that you see, is the relative permeability of sodium. The middle one that you see is the relative permeability of potassium. And the lower one is the relative permeability of calcium. And you can assume then that relative permeability increases. And we're not too concerned about absolute values here. What we're really doing is saying, how do these things change in time? So what you see is that if I look at the permeability over time during an action potential, what happens, and if you look at this time, you see that this time is now 100 milliseconds. It's not 1 or 2 milliseconds like the muscle, the skeletal muscle was. Now it's a lot longer. And what you see is the permeability of the sodium increases very quickly and decreases. What is that reminiscent of? Opening of?
Wait.
Voltage-gated sodium channels with diamond activation gates. Then there's a population of potassium channels that close initially and then open slowly. We won't talk about the mechanisms of that, but we see that it closes slowly and it opens and then opens slowly. And there's some voltage-gated calcium channels that open more slowly than the sodium channels, and then gradually close.
Looks like it's the inverse of the potassium.
Well, it looks like it. It may be a little bit, but I think that's probably as much the artist's rendition of what's happening. But what you do see is that this slope and that slope aren't too different at that point. So the real question is, if I now think about my membrane potentials and what it is that causes the membrane potential to increase or decrease, what would you predict the combination of these different permeabilities, what the membrane potential changes would you predict over that 100 milliseconds, 1, 2, 300 milliseconds?
The initial depolarization, like the positive charges on the calcium and the potassium, looks like it almost balance out, but then the spike in the sodium is going to cause like the depolarization, and then it's going to repolarize after that as they all kind of come back to their baseline. Right?
Hear what
that
you said?
Sense?
What you said? Somebody tell me what you said. Were there words in between? Yeah. You heard the key words that you write down in your notes, but then were there words in between? She said that there's going to be depolarization, and she implied that the depolarization of that membrane is going to be a result of what?
Leak channels.
We don't have leak channels on here. Kelly, what was the initial deposit that you're talking about?
The sodium
channel. The sodium channels open real fast and close real fast. And so if I really got inside her head and could visualize what she was seeing, she saw the same kind of depolarization that she saw with the action potential in the axon, and the same kind of depolarization, the action potential that she saw in the skeletal muscle sarcolemma, right? And then what did she say? The calcium and potassium balance each other out. So what do you think is happening? If they balance each other out, what do you think is happening to the membrane? One opens and one closes, but what happens to the membrane potential? So now you've told me that the membrane potential, what she said was the membrane potential over that time, if the membrane potential was going to, here's time, here's millivolts. It's going to start out someplace, and she says, the voltage-gated sodium channels with time and activation gates are opening, and this is depolarizing real fast. And then she said, gee, it looks like the sodium and the potassium and calcium are kind of balancing each other out. So what do you think this waveform is doing?
I have a question. So when it doesn't seem much different to me when I said the calcium and potassium for some reason, or can you tell me that wasn't correct? But now
well, I said it looks, it looks pretty much. It looks, I said, the closeness of that reciprocal, I said, is probably more, the closeness to form waveforms is probably more the artist than what really happens. But it's true that the membrane, that the potassium channels close slowly, and the calcium channels open slowly, okay? And then the potassium channels start to open again, and the calcium close again. That's fine.
Okay,
no,
that was confusing because I felt like I was trying to make that connection, and that wasn't correct, and so I erased that connection.
No, the qualitative connection is fine. It's the quantitation that I wasn't sure about. So tell me what's going on. When the permeability for potassium increases, what's going to move across the membrane?
Potassium.
Potassium's going to do what? It's going to go out of the cell. Okay. So what's going to happen? So if I look at this piece of the curve here, do you think that this is going to cause depolarization or repolarization of the membrane? Make up your mind. If the permeability of potassium decreases, is the membrane potential get more negative or less negative?
More negative.
Less
negative.
Less negative. Why is that? Because he says there's more positives on the inside of the cell than the outside of the cell. The permeability of the potassium is less. Less potassium is going to leave the cell. So there won't be as big an accumulation on the outside of the cell. And so, gee, what happens here is it's going to get less negative or more positive. This means, because I'm looking at relative permeability, this means the potassium gates are closing. If potassium gates are closing, the effect of that is going to be to cause depolarization of the membrane, not repolarization. What's going to happen here? Well, for our purposes, that's a quantitative difference, maybe, depending on what the gradients are. But we'll not concern ourselves too much with that. Let's say, where are positives going? Are they going in or out? And where are the gradients that are taking? So, what's the difference in movement between calcium here and here?
They're moving.
Which way are they moving? They're moving into the cell. Why are they moving into the cell? Because
calcium gates are open. There's a gradient.
There's a gradient on the extracellular fluid. The extracellular fluid. See that? Same gradient. Now what you're saying is that, gee, this is causing, this looks like it's causing the membrane potential to become less negative. This looks like it's causing the membrane potential to be less negative. Right? Here there are less potassium going, less positive going up. Here there are more positive going in. So I'm going to still see some depolarization. So now what you see is I've gotten a lot more. So if I look at this region here, right here, what I see is what Kelly told me is that this is depolarizing, and now that depolarization really has three components to it, three contributors. One is the voltage-gated sodium channels and sodium movement. One is the calcium movement into the cell, and one is potassium movement out of the cell. But the net result is that I have depolarization. And then what happens? Okay. So what she said was that what I see here is that more potassium is going to leave, less calcium is going to come in, and the result of that, she says that's going to make it a little more negative. And what's going to happen right here, do you think? As Megan said, it looks like they're reciprocal. So what do you think is happening to the relative amount going in, the relative amount going out? They're balancing. If they balance, what's happening to the membrane potential? Is it going back to the baseline? If the balance, if the amount coming in, the amount going out are balanced, it's staying the same. So gee, you know, that looks like that's going to stay the same. And then what happens? More potassium comes in. Less calcium comes in. It gets more negative because less calcium comes in. More potassium leaves. So now I have an action potential. On Monday, I want you to look at this, decide if that makes sense to you, and then I want you to tell me, from your understanding of skeletal muscle, what you think
keep our muscle contracted.
We will collect cards. Don't forget your name tags.
Are you handing out the test?
Carol. And some quizzes, and in the future, please. And in the future, ladies, I would very much appreciate it. Listen up! I would very much appreciate it that when you're in this room, in this community, dealing with our learning, that you focus on physiology and not on the internet and not on games and not on texting and not on any other subject.
Physiology. I am.
Flipping to the other side.
Oh, yeah. Jesse, can I stick here? I have to because they're staying there.
This quiz does not include cardiovascular things.
Are you flipping that way?
Yeah. Follow the instructions.
Thank you.
Are you going to be here?
Yes. I don't have a plug-in.
Are you going to be down this way?
I forgot my home.
Feel free.
Yeah,
take it.
Do you
want to
sit here?
I have
to go over
Okay, does everybody have a quiz? Listen up. Pay attention to the instructions. If you don't put your name on every page, those pages that don't have names will not be graded. And there's a reason for that. We'll talk about it next time.